People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is People of Note and Rodney Trudgeon here on Fine Music Radio, welcoming you to this week's edition of the program. I'm going to be introducing you to a guest that I'm certainly very pleased to see after many years, paying a visit to South Africa to play some concerts, and that is the violinist Gina Bjorkus. You'll remember her, I'm sure, as concertmaster of the Cape Town Symphony Orchestra, what, more than 20 years ago? And Gina has now settled in Belgium after travelling from Johannesburg to Stellenbosch, Cape Town to London. Home is now in a village close to Brussels, Ghent and Antwerp, where from 2010 she took a sabbatical from the London Symphony Orchestra, where she then played in the viola section. Gina, it's lovely to welcome you back to Cape Town, rain and all. Welcome.
It's lovely to be here, thank you.
Do you come out frequently?
Not that frequently, but I have friends in Pretoria who own a theatre, and every now and again I get a phone call and then they force me to come home.
This move of yours, apparently, to Brussels was because life was getting hectic. You had a baby. You wanted to take a sabbatical. Just tell me how that all came about and why.
Well, I was finding that I was touring more and more, and I was spending less and less time with my child. So I asked the orchestra, would it be okay if I took a year off? And they agreed. And I just went somewhere close because I didn't want to travel too far, and I wanted to be close to London in case I needed to get there. So we stayed there, and my daughter fell in love with the place. She learned to speak Flemish within a year. And
really? Flemish?
Yes. She's fluent in Flemish, Russian, Polish, English, you name it.
And so is she a musician?
No. I've stood between her and music like the Berlin Wall.
Shame.
She sings lovely, lovely jazz lyrics, and she's playing the saxophone now.
Oh, okay. I wanted to, there's so many questions I want to ask you, Gina, because you really have had a stunning career and you've worked with some truly great conductors that we all know and in great orchestras. And the London Symphony Orchestra is pretty well your home at the moment, isn't it? That's the orchestra you've taken the sabbatical from.
Yes, but I've actually got another job now in Belgium. I went to audition for Opera Flandre, and I think I was about 40 years older than everybody else and got through to the final round by some miracle, and they gave me the job, and all that I could think was granny power.
Oh, really? And are you happy in that orchestra?
Yes, it's a little opera house, and they do quite amazing products for such a small opera house. Mm-hmm. And they've actually just been awarded an award for one of the best opera houses in the world. So they do amazing work.
What I want to, the question I must ask you is, of course, the big news in the classical industry is Sir Simon Rattle. Absolutely. Leaving Berlin after his tenure there and going to take over the London Symphony Orchestra. And so you must have had some direct experience with him coming across to London. How has he been received in London? You don't have to, if it's confidential.
I think it's been a really great homecoming for him. It looks like he feels at home with the orchestra. He's a very kind person. He's really got the gift of the gab. He knows mm-hmm. how to bring out the best in people. He's building an enormous education center for them to do the outreach work, and also a new theater. And he has a way with people that they just want to give to the orchestra. You know, apart from which, he comes now with years of experience behind him. And all the repertoire we're doing, it's just great playing with him. He knows exactly what he wants and how to get it, and he's absolutely approachable.
And he is also, I think, as he did in Berlin, he works with some quite modern repertoire as well, doesn't he?
Yes, he's bringing a lot of interesting programs mm-hmm. into our repertoire.
So what position, when you are in the LSO, what position do you play?
I was a violist there because I went from violin in the London Philharmonic Orchestra, and I decided I want to just a change. And I phoned LSO, and this was 9 days before the audition. They had a percussion opening and a viola opening. So I tried to learn the viola and somehow managed to get the job.
No, but you must have learned the viola before that, surely.
I'd fiddled with it, but it was really paint by numbers.
And you got the job.
Yes.
Good grief.
I memorized the first 3 months because I could barely read the clef.
I was going to say, it's so different. And I mean, it must feel so different.
It feels different, but I've got used to it now. I actually, if I have to play both in a concert, I practice using mm-hmm. both, because it's like anything else. Once your sensory muscles learn where things are, you reproduce it.
But also the actual music, Gina, the viola parts are so different in a sense. That's all the inner voices, isn't it? The sort of mid-range voices.
Well, there's a reason why Mozart loved playing the viola.
There you go.
It really is the glue of the orchestra. You know, the second violin parts that I played, that's the engine. It keeps the motion going. They often have the fast semiquavers. The violas, I find it's really where the glue. When the ship is rocking, we glue it. And I think we're very underappreciated.
No, well, shall we start telling viola jokes? Gina, when I was in Berlin, I heard Simon Rattle conduct all Beethoven symphonies. And the one thing I remember, it's also come out on the recording, and the recording of the Beethoven symphonies did with the Vienna Philharmonic, he clearly got the violas to play a slightly more substantial role in the sound. I remember hearing the Pastoral Symphony and hearing sounds I'd not heard before, and it was the violas that he was bringing out.
He often brings out inside voices. It's very interesting. He knows what he wants, and it's obvious from the first rehearsal. He's well prepared. He knows what he wants.
Mm-hmm. And has the orchestra sort of accepted him as a sort of breath of fresh air and an injection of enthusiasm?
I think they're very happy with their new music director.
And I think he also wanted to build a concert hall, and that's been a bit of a controversy at the moment.
Yes, especially with Brexit happening the shenanigans there.
Yes.
But he has an enormous way with people, and I've seen him pull the whole of the London political system behind him. Mm-hmm. It's astounding how he can do it. I think really he should just be the Prime Minister.
which would probably be a good thing at the moment. Gina, let's go to your first piece of music, and I can't help noticing that you've chosen Star Wars, the main theme. I'm a bit surprised, but now I realize why. John Williams' music, and John Williams likes working with the LSO, doesn't it, when film...
He loves working
because apparently
with
the LSO is a brilliant sight-reading orchestra.
Yes, he's actually said often when he's approached, there's two things you do need in film music: precision, sight-reading, both of which the LSO... You know, they've done film music for years and years, and I found coming into the orchestra, you learn within an hour how fast you have to sight-read, how fast you have to work, and you get told in no uncertain terms, you will be on your best behavior. So he's often, you know, said, we work with amazing conductors, but when a film conductor comes, the orchestra really pays them the same respect.
I
think that puts him, you know, as somebody said, his music was blessed by LSO because their sound is so amazing. The brass section is astounding. I know with Star Wars, you know, the trumpeter, it was his first day at work. And he played the first bar and we knew he was going to get the job.
And when you hear the film, when you hear the soundtrack in one of these modern cinemas, IMAX or 3D or whatever, that when that theme begins, it's goose flesh stuff, isn't it? It's that sound of the LSO and John Williams at
their
best.
Well, also, I think John Williams is quite proud of the fact that he can manipulate people's emotions. So if we play it at a children's concert, if we play it in Japan, if we play it wherever, it unites people, it unites cultures. He really knows, you know, he's such a diverse composer. And his leitmotifs are so instantly recognizable that wherever you play the first bar, the audience is in your hands.
Right, here it is, Star Wars, with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by John Williams. Gosh, we know that so well. The world knows that so well. The main theme from Star Wars with the London Symphony Orchestra conducted by the composer John Williams. And the first choice of my guest, Gina Bjorkes, who's got direct experience with the London Symphony Orchestra, this magnificent orchestra in London. It's interesting, Gina, that London has so many famous orchestras and how different they all sound, because the London Philharmonic and the Royal Philharmonic don't have, now I've got to be careful what I say, London Symphony has got a kind of a glittering sound. Mm. And maybe it's because, as you say, the brass and all that.
And it's also the repertoire. You know, when I played in London Philharmonic, I loved playing Brahms and Haydn and things with them. And then when I came to LSO, they were playing Stravinsky and Bartok and all the big things. Mm-hmm. So the repertoire is different. The way the wind players play is different. Yeah, it's a different animal, each orchestra. And when I go to concerts with Philharmonia, that's a different animal again.
Yes. Mm. And when you are in the London Symphony Orchestra, is there a good atmosphere within the orchestra?
It's the kindest orchestra I've worked with.
Oh, really? That's
they
interesting.
They are amazing people. The touring that we did, they were my family. Mm-hmm. They become a family.
And the other thing, just looking at your bio here, and I have to ask you this now, you've worked with some such famous conductors, let alone orchestras. I'm just going to mention a few of them, but they're the big names, the big recording conductors: George Schulte, Valery Gergiev, Kurt Mazur, Bernard Haitink, Wolfgang Sawallisch, Franz Welser Moerst, one of my favorites, Colin Davis, Christoph Eschenbach, Daniel Barenboim. Was it exciting for you to come across these people firsthand initially?
It was frightening.
These big names, was it? Was it
frightening when I got there, because I had only seen them on record covers, and well, in those days, record covers.
Yeah.
But as I worked with them, I realized how easy they make life, because things really just work. Haitink paces music beautifully. You know, you're going to play all the notes that night. There's going to be no faking, because he knows exactly what the orchestra can do, how to get it out of them. Barenboim, I remember I went to him after one of the concerts and said, tonight I just went to heaven. And he said, put on your violin, we kiss. and Mazur could be frightening, you know, when he said friends, then you knew you're in trouble. Gergiev, amazing, just amazing. You never knew what's going to happen in the next second. You know, he's the opposite to Haitink. It was astounding.
Schulte
was
the screaming skull. As they called
him. He would, after the rehearsals, he'd say, go home and get a life. But he was a harsh, you didn't mess around when he was there.
Yeah.
But it was astounding. I worked with him one of the last concerts he did. He was right before he died. And his score was magnified to about four times the size it should have been. But he stood there through Don Giovanni and didn't budge. You felt like you were with a 16-year-old man conducting.
And did you feel in the orchestra in rehearsals that incredible energy that he's so famous for, a sort of almost relentless energy?
It's energy and blind fear, I think.
Really? On his part or your part? But one of the ones, and I mentioned, I have always been a great fan of Sir Colin Davis. Really, he's Mozart, he's Beethoven, Berlioz, of course, but he's such a fine conductor, and I hope you're going to say something nice about him.
Yes, I can remember two very clear experiences I had. I was sitting studying a score one day before rehearsal, and he came to me and I said, you know, Colin, I want to ask you a question. A lot of my CDs come post-Second World War, and that's when the music making was astounding in the world. How did you do it? Because warehouses of instruments were blown up. People were being moved around Europe. And he said, my dear, all that we had left was our imagination. And I'll never forget that. And the other thing that he said to me that I often say when I'm coaching an orchestra or I do a little bit of conducting sometimes is, nobody is right. That was one of his sayings. Mm-hmm. Nobody's right. And if one can remember that, it's like a good marriage. You know, it's a compromise from the beginning of the concert to the end. And if somebody's not aware of you, become aware of them and help them. Mm-hmm. And that's how you get to play together. If you're playing in a stubborn approach, the ensemble goes to pieces.
I think what I envy you for, apart from the fact that you met with and worked and interacted with these people, is the rehearsals. It must have been fascinating. You know, one day suddenly you're rehearsing a symphony with Schulte, the next week or the next month with Colin Davis or Barenboim or Gergiev.
Well, I still look at schedules and I think, wow. Wow, what a life I've had. Yeah. You know, when I retire, I will have no regrets. Mm-hmm. I have really been very blessed.
But Gina, through all of this, you have still kept up major solo career. You play a number of concertos, you play chamber music.
Yes, I think my family gets a bit tired of me because I'm practicing all the time, basically, when I'm not working. But I think it's important because if you're playing in orchestras of this caliber, even if you're playing in an orchestra not of that caliber, you're even more responsible because you kind of have to contribute more. And the only way really to keep your playing together is to practice all the time. And if you don't have a concert or something lined up, I mean, we're human beings. I'm going to sit under a tree and have a gin and tonic if I don't have a concert.
So it's the constant discipline, isn't it, that's needed that makes a successful musician.
And also I find teaching is very good.
Yes, you mentioned.
Yeah,
I enjoy teaching.
I enjoy teaching. I don't do a lot because I don't have a lot of time, but I'm very proud. Some of my students in the last 2 years have taken most of the jobs in Belgium. So
that's very good for you.
When you coach them, you learn as well.
And then chamber music, because your next piece that we're coming to now is the Schubert Rosamunde Quartet. I mean, do you enjoy, you belong to a quartet, don't you?
Yes, I've played in a quartet sort of every summer for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And I think we're the only quartet in the world that doesn't fight.
Really? Do they fight quartets?
They are unbelievable. It's like four siblings.
Because you always think that they're so happy together.
No, I think a lot of quartets, I know I've been in quartets where you want to kill the person next to you because they know where your buttons are and they push them.
Oh dear. But what is the name of this famous quartet?
This is the Barbican Quartet, and we've been very lucky to play with an ex-principal of the cello section. He actually studied with Rostropovich, met Shostakovich, so we have a direct line there. Mm-hmm. I've loved playing with Murray. He's just so encouraging, and he simplifies everything. He's like a good conductor.
Yeah.
So we've been, all of us are a bit younger than him, and we've played with him. And actually, this quartet for me was really a souvenir in my life because we worked very hard at this quartet, and we played it in France, and it just worked so beautifully that night. I'll never forget it. That restless theme in the second violin. It's just the door opens and you're in a different world.
So what are we going to hear? We're going to hear a bit of the first movement
first
up
movement
to the second theme.
First movement is for me just heaven when it just opens up and you open the door and there you are in another century.
And who's playing this?
This is the Hagen Quartet, very young Hagen Quartet playing this.
Thank you.
It's always sad to fade. You know, on this program, Gina, we have to fade some of these great pieces. Otherwise, we'll have no chance to talk to you. Part of the first movement of the Rosamunde Quartet by Schubert and played by the group with the Hagen Quartet, you said, of young players. And another choice for my guest, Gina Bjorkes, who's here in Cape Town. She's performed concerts around the country and is telling us about her glamorous life in London with all these famous conductors and orchestras. But I just want to spend a few moments now going back. Let's just do a chronological thing. You've been playing pretty well all your life, haven't you? You started when you were...
Five.
Oh, really? As young as that? And was the violin?
Yes, my mother played in a trio, and I said I liked the violin, and within minutes we were in the car, she raced me off to Johannesburg, and she bought me a violin.
Really? Oh, so your parents were also musical?
Yes, my mother was a music teacher, and my father played jazz.
Okay.
Yeah.
And your brother, Wessel, is a cellist.
Yes.
Whom I knew so well in Johannesburg when he was with the orchestra there. So it's very much a musical family, isn't it?
Yes, yes. We all did music.
And so, Gina, when did things start taking off for you? Because I know you've had so much experience in South Africa, in orchestras here, and playing concertos and chamber music. When did you go overseas?
I left school quite young and finished a correspondence course and then played in a restaurant. And Alan, my violin teacher, Alan Solomon, said that's when I really learned to play, because every night you have to communicate with new people. And then very rich patron came in. Well, he became my patron. Marino Chiavelli came to have dinner and offered to pay for my studies.
Is that the same Chiavelli we know from the famous Chiavelli?
Yes, and he just offered to pay for my studies.
Gosh.
And off I went, and I first got a bursary, actually, to go to Cincinnati. And then in 2 years, I went to audition for Juilliard and moved on. Miss Dorothy DeLay had been here giving master classes, so she knew about me, and she'd suggested I come and study with her. So she suggested I go to Cincinnati 2 years. I got a good grounding there, cleaned up my technique, and then moved on to Juilliard.
And how did you enjoy the American scene, so to speak?
It was fabulous when I was a student. They have amazing recruiting power, so you have very good musicians around you, and that always lifts the ceiling. Mm-hmm. There were competition winners, and we had the Juilliard Quartet coaching us, and we had to play in the orchestra, and we traveled to China with the orchestra. It was an amazing time. And I remember getting to Mr. Lane. She said, "Honey, can I have your repertoire list?" And when I gave it to her, she said, "Oh, dear, we have to work."
We have to talk. And after America, then, did you pretty well go straight to the UK?
No, I came home and I led the Cape Town Orchestra for a while.
Because
actually, yes, my sponsor died and I had a year of tuition to pay off, which was very good. I played many concertos and the rand was very weak, so I had to play a lot of concertos, which was a good exercise. And once that was completed and I played off my debt, I did a year or two in Cape Town Orchestra. And then I went back to the UK and got a job in the London Philharmonic. Okay. I was stunned. I couldn't believe I'd managed that, because it was a principal job.
That with the violin or
yes.
the viola?
Yes, the violin. I was principal second.
Am I right in saying, I'm just trying to scratch my memory, didn't you used to come on stage as concertmaster dressed in a dinner jacket or tails or something?
Yes, I still do that.
Do you?
You know, when there's so much discussion about women's clothes, and if I wear men's clothes, I don't have to go to the women's meetings, you know, the straps or no straps. I just wear tails, there's no discussion.
How was that accepted, like in the UK?
In the London Philharmonic, they seemed okay with it, but I actually approached the London Symphony Orchestra. I said, "Is this allowed?" And they said, "Well, women wear all black, so just wear a black shirt." And then I just carried on wearing my tails. It's wonderful. You don't have to think. You go to the cupboard, get the tails, go to work.
Yes. And especially, and if you're playing solo, because one of the potentially distracting things about a lady soloist is how they come on the stage.
Exactly. It's like,
and you sit there wondering if the dress is going to fall off.
Fall off. Or yeah, exactly. Out. Exactly. And I've seen it happen. Actually, this concert I'm doing now, I am George Sand telling a love affair about mine, Chopin's love affair. And she wore men's clothes. So mm-hmm. I'm very comfortable. I can wear my tails and pretend to smoke a cigar.
You don't actually smoke a cigar,
no,
do
no,
you?
No.
That's quite an interesting concept, and people who would have seen you last night will know what you're talking about. Perhaps for those of us who weren't lucky enough to be there, what sort of program then was it?
Basically, I've got tired of going to concerts and having to read program notes and see, like you say, the woman in the lavender dress playing a concert. So I've sort of revamped the way I do recitals. I read lots of books before, and then I tell the story. I might even impersonate somebody else to tell the story, because I found even playing, you know, we have to get people to come to concerts. And even people who know nothing about music, if you tell them a story, they remember the music and the story, and they've often come to me and said, I want to go to concerts now. Mm-hmm. So for this concert, I just took on a different persona. I'm George Sand.
Right through the concert.
Yes, yes. And in Cape Town, I also talk beyond her death of all the women that were liberated and achieved after her, right to the present day, to astronauts.
Oh, right.
Yeah. We go from her to Poland, to Russia, to Gubaj Dolina, and then we talk about the astronauts.
It is a very original and interesting approach, isn't it? I mean, it is original, isn't it? I can't remember that being done before.
Well, when they approached me and I threw the idea at Cape Town, I thought, they'll never accept this. And I was thrilled when they said, oh, we'd love to hear that. I thought it was a good idea in this time when women are, you know, the Me Too movement, the woman liberating. It's a good thing then. And, you know, yesterday when I rehearsed with a pianist, this music is gorgeous. It almost makes me angry that it hasn't been played a lot.
Mm-hmm. Who is your pianist in this tour?
Estia Kruger.
Oh, there you go. There's a bit of your Afrikaans accent coming out. Gina, thank you. I can't believe that we're having some pop music coming up now. What's going on? Lou Reed.
Perfect. Yes, day. We were talking about Schubert and, you know, this little concert we played on a hill in France in a very old church, and it was just a magical evening. And I just had this song going through my head as I walked off the stage. I thought, this is a perfect day. It doesn't get any better than this.
Just a perfect day. Drink sangria in the park. And then later, when it gets dark, we go home. Just a perfect day. Feed animals in the zoo. Then later, a movie too, and then home. Oh, it's such a perfect day. I'm glad I spent it with you. Oh, such a perfect day. You just keep me hanging on. You just keep. Just a perfect day. Problems all left alone. Weekenders on our own. It's such fun. Just a perfect day. You made me forget myself. I thought I was someone else, someone good. Oh, it's such a perfect day. I'm glad I spent it with you. Oh, such a perfect day. You just keep me hanging on. You just just keep me hanging on. You're going to reap just what you sow. Just what you sow. You're going to reap just what you sow.
Well, an unexpected choice there from my guest, Lou Reed, Perfect Day, and at the choice of Gina Bukas, the violinist back in South Africa, to give some concerts, as we've heard. And Gina, that makes sense and somehow fitted in, didn't it? And I can imagine you thinking that as you walked off the stage that evening. I wanted to ask you now about the repertoire. I mean, you seem to have played all the major violin concertos, but you...
Not yet.
Oh, really? Not yet. Oh.
Next life.
Which one haven't you played that you're dying to play?
Oh, Schoenberg. I'd love to play the Schoenberg.
Now, I want to talk to you about the Schoenberg, and I was going to bring it up later. Mm. When I was in Berlin, I think our listeners get tired of me saying when I was in Berlin, in March of this year, it was played with the Berlin Philharmonic and their new conductor, Kirill Petrenko, and the soloist, whose name I actually can't remember, but I know it began with a P, a young lady, Paparicato or something. Anyway, I thought, I wonder if I should read something about it. So I started reading something about it, and I thought, no, let me just rather listen.
Listen.
Because it's not easy to listen to, and apparently it's fiendishly difficult to play.
Yes, yes.
So why do you want to play it?
I just love the noise it makes.
I have to say, it was a very riveting experience, and there's some very impressive orchestral moments as well. I think in the third movement, there's a massive orchestral tutti that's completely overwhelming, in fact.
I played his Fantasiestück, and I loved it so much. But I don't know if it's one of those that's more rewarding for the player.
Mm-hmm. Than for the audience,
yeah.
And you know what? And I wonder if you would... Well, I can imagine you doing this, I'm sure you wouldn't. The soloist, when she came on the platform, I thought, what is she doing? She took her shoes off.
Ah, I love her.
She took her shoes off, and she came back to play an encore. And for the encore, she got the principal clarinet of the orchestra, Andreas Ortenzamer, to play with her, a little piece by Darius Muir, I think. And then when they'd taken the bow, she was shuffling back into her shoes to walk off. So you suddenly love her. I'll find out the name and let you know.
Wonderful.
Anyway, back to business now. I like the two quotes I want to read here in Music Reviews. Elspeth Jack says, "There's nothing shy or retiring about this artist." And I've always associated that with you. There's tremendous passion. And John Allison says, "Gina Bukas is a violinist who means business." Every bar of her playing, whether lyrical or tempestuous, is full of passion. And I think that's what we listeners want from a musician. Do you agree? We want you to do that.
I agree, and I find a lot of the new industries, sometimes they flatten the whole experience. Mm. You know, it has to be perfect. And always when I play with orchestras, when I play with kids, when I play with, I say, I love mistakes. Let's show our humanity, but let's make music. And it's a struggle. If you're at home thinking, should this be louder, softer, louder, softer, louder, softer, maybe faster, slower, I don't then want to go and play vanilla on stage. Mm. We want to really make an impression so that you go away. I mean, what's the point of being on the earth if we don't enjoy and really live?
True. That is true. So your repertoire is quite wide. You don't have a preference for any particular part of the repertoire.
No.
It's like you said, Schoenberg, but you've also played Mozart and Bach. So this is the two extremes. And so it must be hugely challenging and probably a challenge that you want as well.
Well, recently I was asked to conduct and I really slammed on the handbrake. But then I read something actually that Richard Branson had said. He said, if somebody offers you an opportunity and you don't know how to do it, say yes and learn.
That's very good advice. So are you conducting a bit?
I'm starting a little bit. I like it because it's the most amazing feeling when you sculpt a phrase and they reproduce it. Mm. And you stand there and you see these excited eyes and music happening. It's wonderful.
Well, look at how many women conductors are now making it big time, like really big time. Mm. Mm. If I knew how to pronounce the name of the woman in Birmingham, I would
exactly.
say Mirga, Gratinia, something like that.
But I also read the other day a woman conductor who had been playing in Chicago. They said, "How was it?" And she said, "It was terrifying to make music without my instrument." So
that's
also
interesting.
That is
interesting. Well, now look, we've got some Mahler coming up now, and I'm sure the London Symphony Orchestra certainly is able to play Mahler brilliantly, but you've chosen George Sell, Mahler 4, part of the slow movement. And the reason for this?
Well, it's a well-known recording. And when I listened to the beginning, you know, this whole movement is about, it's a child talking. Mm. It's about really just being completely naive, in touch with nature. It's as John Cleese says, never forget the child in you.
John Cleese said that.
Yes. And amongst other people, yes. They probably said similar things. But for me, this is a very special movement. It's for me one of the really the most quiet places in the world that there is. And when in this particular recording, it's extremely quiet at the beginning. And this is what I love about this. You know, there's people who like fast music and slow music. I love slow music. It makes me extremely happy. So this quiet place that he's found for me is magical. It's just magical.
Thank you.
Well, again, we have to fade there. That wonderful sound world that Mahler created. And you, Gina, must have played in many Mahler symphonies with the London Symphony Orchestra. Have you?
I've played all of them.
Have you? Yeah. Every one of them?
Yeah, with many different conductors.
But there and we had George Sell with the Cleveland Orchestra. Quite a famous, quite a controversial recording. But he, also famous and controversial, and very much people were terrified of him.
Terrified of him, apparently.
Yeah. But is it true these days, you know, conductors don't behave like that, we hear, anymore, because of trade unions and things? You don't get the kind of Schulte Sell.
No, it has stopped. And also, you know, playing in the orchestras that I've played in, they do not tolerate that sort of behavior anymore. And it's just much more pleasant working in a good atmosphere. I know when I was in Pretoria now conducting, and they came after us, they said, that was such fun. And I said, well, that's what it's supposed to be. Mm-hmm. If we're happy, we'll make better music and the audience will feel it.
Well, I mean, some of those great conductors got fantastic results as a result of their dictatorial nature, didn't they? Liked Sell with these things. And although this is a bit of a gossip now, you might know that very recently Daniel Barenboim got into trouble with his Staatskapelle in Berlin. They were worried that they wouldn't renew his thing
because they said
they would come to work terrified. Mm-hmm. They'd have to go through therapy.
This is the thing. You know, you may see the concert, but you don't know the price that's being paid in the background. There are people that have stopped playing because of nervous conditions they develop. So I'm all for people being respectful. Yes, come prepared. Yes, do your work. But then let's make music.
Right. And have fun together.
Exactly.
The other thing that you said earlier, and this is just because recently there was a new Beethoven 9 with Benjamin Zander, and it's the first Beethoven 9, I think, that's under 60 minutes long. It's 58 minutes. But he did, as he always does, a long lecture, and he was obsessed with metronome markings. And I'm a great Furtwängler fan. And I believe, and I don't know how you will answer this, you may completely disagree with me and will have to end the interview in tears, that there's more to music, isn't there, than the marking of a metronome?
Yes, there are certain composers that you know that their metronome marking, really, they were good at putting exactly. Then again, there's other composers that you think, okay, this orchestra or this group of people cannot manage that speed. I think for an audience, my teacher in New York always said, if you play it a bit slower and you play all the notes, it's going to sound faster than if you play it at the tempo and you miss some notes. I think there is a speed where you feel comfortable. And I even find from one day to the next, today I want to play something slowly and tomorrow it doesn't feel right. Mm.
And you also said earlier, Gina, that you enjoy slow music and you enjoy quiet music. Mm. And one of the things I remember about the Berlin, I told you I'm going to go on about this, is their ability to play unbelievably softly when the entire orchestra of 110 is on the stage, still with body to the sound.
For me, this makes a great orchestra. Mm-hmm. When you play softly, you have to be even more expressive. But I know when I hear an orchestra, and you know, some orchestras, they're not even aware of how softly you can play as a group. Mm-hmm. I think the first orchestra I played that really softly with was Chamber Orchestra of Europe. And that's when I realized, wow, a big group of people can play softly. Mm-hmm. And even when I'm playing alone, you know, the softer you play, the harder they have to listen.
That is true. Gina, I think because we're running out of time soon, let's just take another choice of music, because you've chosen 6 pieces. But this one is perhaps even more unexpected than Lou Reed. Freddie Mercury, Another One Bites the Dust. I mean, you are okay, aren't you? nothing has happened to you in the last...
It's when I joined the orchestra in Belgium, they can be... slightly without humor, shall we say. And the first time we walked out of an opera, I'm from a symphonic orchestra. So for me, the operas are really long and I'm exhausted when they finished. And I walked out one night and I suddenly heard Freddie Mercury, Another One Bites the Dust. And my colleagues laughed so much, and now it's a tradition. We all walk out and say, Another One Bites the Dust.
Hey, let's just hear a snatch of that.
Let's go! He walks fairly down the street with the brim pulled way down.
no sound but the sound of speed. Machine guns ready to go. Are you ready? Hey, are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat? Out of the doorway, the bullets rip to the sound of the beat. Yeah. Another one bites the dust. Another one bites the dust. And another one gone. And another one gone. Another one bites the dust. Hey, hey, I'm gonna get to do. Another one bites the dust.
Well, just a snatch. Gosh, that must have shocked our listeners, Gina. Freddie Mercury, another one bites the dust. Who'd have thought? From my guest, Gina Bjorkes, the violinist in Cape Town, to give some concerts. And now, just as we approach the end of the program, we spoke earlier about you and your violin and viola, and I see you've brought them into the studio with us. What instruments do you have? Are they special instruments?
I have a Czech violin, which is very beautiful. It's a copy of the Empress Rad. And I believe, you know, instruments only mature after 200 or 300 years. I think this instrument is going to blossom once I'm gone off the planet, long after I'm gone. Oh, and I do think it's going to be one of the great instruments. It's really blossoming. It's growing beautifully. And what I like about it is it's not moody. It keeps its temperament very well. So I don't have to struggle with a moody instrument. Mm-hmm. And then the viola, I found a modern Italian viola maker, and suddenly one came up in an auction, which I bought. And I took it to a maker in London to say, can you clean it up and fix it? She said, I don't work on modern Italian instruments. And I said, please, just take a look at it. And then she fixed it up, and she phoned me back. She said, can I keep it?
Oh, there you go. There you go. And Gina, when you're playing in the orchestra and as a soloist, would you use the same violin for the orchestra and the solo stuff, concerto stuff?
Yes, yes. You just learn to play much less. Mm-hmm. The viola, sometimes I change to a smaller viola because if it's a long Wagner opera, I have a smaller instrument that I can play on. This one's quite big. But my dream is to have a particular instrument that I've been watching on stage copied one day. because okay. It's the perfect dimension.
You're talking about a violin now.
Viola.
Oh, the viola.
Because
too.
The viola comes in different measurements.
Oh, I didn't
so
know
I'd
that
like to cut a slightly smaller one for myself.
All right. Mm. It's been interesting hearing you talk about the viola, by the way, so it's good to know that you're still doing it. Mm. We're approaching the end of our program, Gina. So what happens now when you go back? Or do you go back to Brussels and back to work?
Yes, I go back to the daily work, but I have another exciting project where I'm going to Amsterdam to guest lead the violas in the opera orchestra there, and we're doing Valkyra, which I've never done. So I'm sure I'm going to be practicing day and night when I get back. My section in Ghent warned me it's very difficult.
But what great music. I mean, you were complaining just now, may I say, about the length of the opera. How are you going to deal with the Wagner opera?
I'm going to build up strength. I'll go to the gym.
But it's a fantastic score, you must admit.
Yeah.
Jokes aside, that Valkyra score.
Well,
all of them
are great. Yeah. So I'm doing that in between all the other operas. So it's going to be full-on opera till Christmas,
okay.
And then I can take a breather.
And you're still with your daughter, I see, is 14 now.
She's 14.
Gosh.
Yes, she's lovely.
Okay. Gina, thank you so much for coming by. And I'm a little bit... Your choice of music has been very interesting. And now we're going to be grabbed by the throat by the sacrificial dance of La Sacra, the Rite of Spring. Is there subtext to this, apart from the fact that it's fantastic music?
Well, I've played it a lot with LSO. In fact, when Sir Simon Rattle came to us and he conducted it the first time with us, he went, "Oh, I see you know this piece." But it's basically a sacrificial virgin dance, which I thought tied in quite well with the theme at the moment of highlighting women composers. And you know, the way we think of it as a sacrificial dance, it wasn't a bad thing, because the woman apparently had to serve the men their mead, their beer, because the men felt that they were absorbing their energy through this. So men know they need us.
Perfect for Women's Month, Gina. Gina Bukas, it's been a delight chatting to you, and I hope we see you again out here soon.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions.
They became the voice of a generation with hits like Cecilia, Mrs. Robinson, Graceland, and so many more. Now relive the memories at Theatre on the Bay from the 31st of July until the 17th of August with Here's to You, the Simon and Garfunkel songbook. Expect all the hits with an 8-piece band that blends nostalgia and imagination. Don't miss Here's to You, from the 31st of July until the 17th of August, only at Theatre on the Bay. Book now. FMR.